with the cross in towards Alfonso Davies. Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar. A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades finally arrives.
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner, Peter Galindo, and Alexander Gonge-Rujic.
Hey there, and welcome in, folks, to episode 130 of the Northern Football Podcast, a slightly delayed episode of Northern Football, but Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gonge-Rujic for this one as we preview the Women's World Cup and also dissect Canada's Gold Cup campaign for the men's national team. Alex, how's it been? Been a little bit since we did our last podcast.
Yeah, it's been good, and feels like, yeah, last time we spoke was to round up the Gold Cup. And since then, Canada went and, you know, played in a very entertaining quarterfinal. And now, you know, the World Cup's just around the corner. So it's all kind of been picking up steam and whatnot. So super exciting on that regard.
And we'll dive into the Gold Cup as well and that exciting quarterfinal against the United States. Of course, the U.S. then falling out to Panama in the semifinal, and Panama then losing to Mexico in the final as Mexico wins yet another Gold Cup, but kind of nice to see the U.S. not win one. But first, we'll get into our Canadian women's national team chat. Would love more questions on this, not many questions on this at all, but it's been a minute. The roster's out. Desiree Scott misses out on this tournament. Olivia Smith is a bit of a surprise inclusion in Bev Priestman's final roster. But just your initial thoughts on the roster, as well as what you've been able to dive into.
Yeah, I think it wasn't that surprising, perhaps, what we saw. You know, just for the most part, a lot of expected faces. Really, the big questions were going to be around the injuries. And Nichelle Prince, Deanne Rose, good to go. I don't think that was surprising, say. Maybe Prince a little more so, but I think it was clear that Bev Priestman really wanted them in. Even if you're getting 15, 30 out of them, just, you know, maybe that'll mean a bit more of a bigger role for a Chloe Lacasse, for example, or, you know, even Adrienne and Leon, despite not playing, maybe she'll end up playing a bigger role. Certainly a question is, like, what's Canada's situation out wide? But Prince and Rose were always going to be in it, felt like, just based on where things are trending. A bit of a surprise not to see Clarissa Larrissey, though, to help that winger depth. But Olivia Smith, it's a fascinating one. It feels like there's always going to be a surprise, and she ends up being that surprise. And you know what? It's one where it's like, it's one of those picks where you know, it's intriguing because it's a high potential pick. And it's one of those where if Bev Priestman thinks she's ready, it's one I'm all on board for, just because we've seen with Smith, she has just such this immense talent and potential. And if, you know, World Cup can be the way for her to really take that next step, I think it's good as well that she's about to go professional, because sometimes for players like her, we've seen it with Jessie Fleming in the past, for example, where they burst on the scene at 15, 16, and then they go to college and they can kind of stagnate at the ages of 20, 21, 22. So the fact that Smith is also about to hop right into a pro environment, this could be a big, you know, tournament for her, even if she's only plays 10 minutes across the entire tournament, just to really get a taste of that next level. So Smith was a surprise, but it's one where I was, you know, I'm on board. And otherwise, good to see Gabby Carl get a look. Just feels like she deserved to get in. It's unfortunate that an injury got her in, but her versatility is going to be a big plus. And I think lastly, the big loss is really Desiree Scott. I think Jade Rose was certainly a loss, but Canada does have the center back and fullback depth, especially with Carl slotting in. But Desiree Scott is one where Canada doesn't really have a natural replacement for her. Quinn can play the six, and I think should be starting at the six anyways. But in terms of a pure defensive stopper, Canada has lacked Scott, and you can see their defensive results always seem to crater when she's not around the team. So that one is a bit of a big loss, although maybe this will be what Quinn needs to really take over that number six position.
Yeah, and I don't think Smith's inclusion in the roster was necessarily a surprise, given the fact that she's gotten opportunities with the senior national team in the past. She was already in Australia as part of the training squad. So, I mean, she was a very easy call up. It was just adding her name to the list. And I do think it's important that Desiree Scott was a part of that group as well, because even though she's not a part of the final roster, she was able to spend time around a good chunk of this group for a couple weeks and offer at least a chance to offer some of her experience, as well as give her best a crack the roster, which wasn't necessarily enough at the end of the day. But I think she will still play a role in this, even though she's not there for the final roster in terms of Desiree Scott.
Yeah, I think it's one of those where, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if she does stick around or if she just goes back to Kansas and focuses on rehabbing. It could make sense to do that just given the facilities they have. But yeah, hopefully it's something where, that experience is key, because this is a young midfield group now, right? Like, obviously Sophie Schmidt is there, but other than Sophie Schmidt, it's Simi Owuzie's first World Cup, brand new. Jessie Fleming, of course, had her third World Cup, but still, 25. Julia Grosso as well, like 22. Also at her second World Cup, like it's something where Quinn from second or third World Cup as well. It's something where it's a bit of a younger group, so it's going to be interesting to see. And especially it's a lighter group now with no Scott, just five natural midfielders in the squad. Going to be interesting to see. You have to imagine Christine Sinclair ends up being the sixth midfielder, but we'll see what Bev Priestman does with her. So it is something where Scott's loss is going to be felt in that lack of veteran presence, in that lack of numbers. But we'll see if Canada's able to make up the numbers in another way.
And outside of Christine Sinclair, who would you say is maybe the most vital veteran in this group, since it is a fairly young Canadian group?
I mean, that's a good question. I think, Sophie Schmidt is certainly going to be up there. I think it's something where we've seen the resurgence she's kind of had with the Houston Dash over the last few years, where she was named their MVP of their team last year. And she's just really, taken another step in terms of fitness. I think with Scott not around, she might have to play a bit of a bigger role in midfield than perhaps expected. So I think Sophie Schmidt is certainly a candidate. And I think other than that, I think Alicia Chapman at fullback, she's going to be in tough to get minutes, but as well, she could be a bit of a key leader. But I think that what this shows is just this is, no longer Sinclair, Schmidt, Scott, and Chapman's team anyways, right? Like, of course, they're key parts of it. Don't get me wrong, but I think what we've really seen over the last few years, we kind of saw it at the Olympics, where over the course of the tournament, it was your Fleming stepping up, it was your Grossos, it was your Buchanans, your Gilles. This is the new core's team. This is Fleming's team. This is our third World Cup. It's Buchanan. It's Lawrence's. It's, even Grosso's in that mix. And I think we're really going to see their leadership qualities shine, because, yeah, now if you look at it on paper, I mean, we'll get to best 11s. Is Christine Sinclair in a best 11? It's hard to say if she is. And then in that case, if she's not on, if Schmidt aren't on, that means it's going to be, the likes of Kadisha Buchanan wearing the armband. It's going to be Jessie Fleming wearing the armband. And it really shows that this is their team now. And I think Canada's going to go as far as they go. And the leadership of those veterans is going to be more of a supporting role. And I think that's exciting, because these players that we talk about, they're winners, right? They're players that are here now. It's Fleming has won everything pretty much except the Champions League at Chelsea. Buchanan's won five Champions Leagues. Lawrence as well, one of the best at her position. Like, this is going to be really their tournament to take over for Canada. And I think that's exciting.
But attacking has been a bit of a worry over the last little while with the Canadian women's national team. And those concerns weren't exactly alleviated in their closed door pre-tournament friendly with England, a 0-0 draw in that one. There's not many details about this game. Canadian Soccer Daily did sort of piece together what they could about this game. Not many people were able to watch this. I think TSN's Claire Hanna was able to lay eyes on this game. But is there anything we can really learn from a game that nobody really saw?
Absolutely not, other than good to see a clean sheet. That's really the only thing I took away, is just Canada defensively, they're going to go about as far as their defense takes them. And, they slipped up in that regard a bit before, and, the loss to France, even look at, she believes the loss to the U.S. and Japan, they were defensively sloppy. They needed to, clean things up a bit defensively. So no idea if it was something where maybe England hit the bar 16 times and Caitlin Sheridan made 10 saves. We don't know that, but you'd like to think, given the power that England has in the attack, that I was most encouraged by Canada keeping a clean sheet. And that's what they're going to need this tournament, especially if they make it out the group. What's great about knockout, football is you're never losing if you're never conceding, because you go to penalties. Of course, you can argue if penalties, et cetera, lottery, they're not a lottery, but defensive solidity will pay off for you in the knockout stages. So hopefully they can. That was a sign of them being a bit on the right track in that regard. But other than that, I mean, yeah, I guess on the flip side, a lack of goals is a bit of a concern. But also, again, we don't know how, what kind of chances they were generating, what kind of areas they're getting into. And that's the frustration of a closed door result.
Bev Priestman did say that they missed chances, and there's the plural there, and that's not always the case with the Canadian women's national team. So chances is positive, but yeah, it's tough to look into a game that nobody really saw. It's like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody is there to hear it, did it actually make a sound? Well, I mean, there were no goals scored, so they could have very well not played that game either, too. Just posted a photo of Christine Sinclair on the match day graphic. But can Canada realistically rely on their defense like they did at the Olympics? I mean, they're not the attacking team that they once were. Can they just ride clean sheets, ride one goal conceded to a World Cup title, or is that just absolutely inconceivable? I'd say it's probably inconceivable to do that.
I think they can make a deep run of the knockout stages off that. I mean, it's what's tough versus the Olympics is you get that one extra game in the knockouts, right? So it's like that's four games of being perfect defensively versus three where, you know, you win two, all of a sudden you're in a final and anything can kind of happen. But I do think, again, in the knockout stages, defensive teams will typically do well. So I think really the bigger question is, what does the group stages look like? I feel like that's almost the bigger concern for Canada, because I feel like once you get to the knockout stages, once they're playing their game, they can take on anyone in the world. We've seen that over the last few years. Like they can push teams like the US to the brink. You know, they can push, I mean, England, certainly in these in the friendly Brazil, they've beaten a few times, Australia. Like I think the big games are not going to be an issue for Canada in terms of them showing up. Of course, you know, within those games, it'll be about executing, etc. So I think defense that will help. It's really more the group stages because they're going to need to score goals, right? Like 3-0 games in a group stage will eliminate you most times unless you get really lucky with other teams drawing in. They're going up against some solid teams. Ireland defensively is a piece of work to deal with. They frustrated the US. They frustrated a few other teams over the last year. So Canada's going to need to score some goals then. Nigeria as well. I mean, Canada saw it. Nigeria can frustrate them as well in those friendlies last year. Australia as well, no slouch. So I think really their bigger questions are, can they make it the group stage? Because I think as we've seen with Canada in the past, they're a team that blends really well to that knockout environment of just, you know, lock it down, get into that mode and go after it. And it's something where that sort of, again, there's the old adage, defense wins championships, defense wins tournaments. But also you have to put yourself to win it. And that's for me, Canada, can they get the offensive outburst in the group stages? And hey, if they do get it, can they also maintain it where in that, if they're getting a goal or two every knockout game, they will be flying, right? So if they can also get a bit of momentum off that, it is why that offense is so important, especially right from game one. Can they go out against Nigeria and get a goal or three and use that as a momentum boost?
And if you look back at the last couple of tournaments, of course, in France in 2019 and then Canada in 2015, how would you say this team necessarily compares? There seems to be a lot more quality throughout the roster, but it's also a very different outlook in terms of mostly the competition that's improved so globally. And of course, this being a 32-team World Cup as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be fascinating just to see the level. Because, yeah, this 32-team, we're going to see, I think, just really how far a lot of these teams have come. I think we saw last World Cup in 2019, a bit of the bottom end teams struggled a bit. We saw some heavy results. I don't think it's going to be as much as a case this time because the level just continues to improve. And, you know, what I think is going to be fascinating as well is that it feels like this one, obviously the US are favorites, but I don't know. I'm looking at 12, 16 teams that could all realistically make a good run. And I think because of that, the parity and the competition as well could be fascinating. And with the draws as well, there's two teams pretty much in each group that can really, you know, for the most part, that are looking big. Okay, yeah, we can make a run in this. So I think what's going to be, you know, intriguing is just from that round of 16 on, there's going to be so many competitive, tight fought games where anyone can really take it. And that's why for Canada, they'll have belief of once they get to a knockout stages, it's going to be kind of a free-for-all because of the fact that there's a lack of a clear favorite due to injuries or, you know, due to other factors that have cropped up.
When you're looking at sort of Canada's outlook in this tournament, what holds them back? We've already looked at their struggles in attack. We've looked at how astutely defensive they can be, but what holds this team back, maybe aside from their attacking struggles, or is that really the trump card, for lack of a better word, in terms of where this team will fall apart?
Yeah, I'd say I'd also argue, there's a few other things they'll need to answer this tournament, because I think really defense is something where it's the only point of clarity, because it's going to be Sheridan in goal, Buchanan, Gilles, Lawrence, and then likely Riviere, although Chapman could also slot in more, defense first games. But really, I think there's a few questions, like the midfield balance. That one is one that has kind of been an issue. Canada's experimented with 4-4-2s, where it's just Fleming and Grosso in a double pivot. You've seen, Fleming play a bit deeper in a pivot. You've seen Grosso play a bit deeper in the pivot. I think they're going to have to show a lot with their midfield balance, because again, I'll continue to argue that it should be Fleming, Grosso in front of Quinn as the best balance, as Grosso and Fleming are best on the ball. Quinn can be best underneath them. So I'd say, can they get that midfield balance right? Because if not, it could be a lot of tough games. Because look, a lot of teams across the world are pretty world class in midfield, and if your balance is wrong and you're not getting the most out of your players there, you're going to suffer a lot off the ball. Also, we're going to look at who where is the chance generation going to come from? Because for Canada, it hasn't always been chances. There was a time in 2022 or even 2021 where their issue wasn't generating, it was finishing. But a big reason for that was Janine Becky was a very good chance creator from wide balls and set pieces. She's out injured. Can someone step up and deliver that? Chloe Lacasse, yeah, she's an option, but she's also a bit more of a scorer first than, say, a chance generator. So she might not be able to be the one consistently dropping that service. Ashley Lawrence can, but can Canada tactically find a way to reasonably get her up the pitch all the time if she's playing in a fullback role? Or can it be someone, like, can Deanne Rose shoulder that load so soon after an injury? Can Nichelle Prince do the same? So chance generation is a big question. If not, could Canada maybe make themselves a bit more midfield heavy for that chance generation? So really, beyond the fact of just who will score the goals, I think the two areas of concern within the team would be that midfield balance, because I think that if they get it right, it will help them a lot offensively. And then also, what will they do in terms of that lack of wide chance generation? Will it come from, replacing Becky, or, might replacing Becky have to be done a bit more Moneyball style, where it's done in the aggregate and it's going to come from Fleming, Grosso? Maybe, heck, Canada plays a 4-1-2-1-2, very narrow, where you're playing a four-person midfield of Quinn at the base of a diamond, Grosso and Fleming alongside them, Sinclair at the 10, Hoytema-Vient up top. Yeah, it's very narrow. It's very, going down the middle, but then maybe that allows Quinn to drop back into a three and Lawrence and Riviere to get forward and make up for a lack of a Becky, right? Like, there's so many questions that Canada could ask there, and I'm fascinated to see how they address that, because if not, I think a lack of chance generation and just midfield struggles will be too much to overcome when they're playing top level teams that can expose them in both of those areas.
And you kind of hinted at it there, but what is Canada's best lineup for this tournament? The best available lineup, regardless of opponent. I would say you're probably looking at sort of a 4-3-3 with Quinn in that holding midfield position. And I think the back line's pretty well settled. It'll be Ashley Lawrence on the left, Gilles and Buchanan in the middle, and Jade Riviere on the right, Sheridan, of course, in goal. But it's that midfield which is intriguing to me, as well as the attack. You hinted at the midfield. I mean, Sophie Schmidt could play in that six. Quinn, I would imagine, is there though to start. And then Julia Grosso and Jessie Fleming is almost like an attacking double pivot in a sense. But up top, there's options there. And as you say, like Christine Sinclair is not necessarily in that best 11.
Yeah, I just think if Canada's playing a 4-3-3, it's hard to imagine Sinclair slotting in. Because I think, yeah, I think the back four, it's going to be Sheridan in goal. We're going to see Lawrence, Buchanan, Gilles, Riviere. I think that's pretty much the preferred quattro. And I think in midfield, it's got to be Quinn, Fleming, Grosso, with no Scott. Schmidt could slot in, but I just think we'll see Quinn. So then really that front three, I think it's going to be, if we're talking right now, I think it's Lacasse, Hoytema, and Rose. I think from what what we know about Priestman, I also think knowing, that she has seemed to have also shown a preference for Leon, even when unfit, just the energy she brings. I'd also argue Leon, and maybe it could be Leon, Lacasse, Hoytema, but that's probably what I'd expect to see if Canada's playing a 4-3-3. But yeah, there's questions to have. Like, could a 4-1-2-1-2 make sense? Because again, if you have so many questions with the wingers, again, a 4-1-2-1-2, you slot Sinclair in as a 10, then you could play Hoytema, Lacasse up front. You could play Hoytema, Vien up front. You could play Vien, Lacasse up front. So I do wonder if a two striker partnership is explored, because yeah, I think it's something where the 4-3-3 has been Canada's best formation, and that's a reason why they've used it. But I think now, where they stand right now, between their winger depth and between the, Christine Sinclair likely best playing as a midfielder these days, if you're looking at both of those things, it could also be another formation. But yeah, that's probably what I'd say is that 4-3-3 with Lacasse, Hoytema, and Rose. But we'll see if Priestman has any tactical wrinkles, because they might need to just purely out of necessity.
And it's got to be a worry about Adrienne Leon not being necessarily with match sharpness. Like, she's been in camp for a little while now, so she would have gotten some of that sharpness back. But she wasn't really playing on her loan in Portland. That expired. Of course, she struggled to get minutes at Manchester United. So it's been a while since she was playing regularly, but she does always seem to show up for the national team.
Well, that's it. And that's one of those questions, right? Because it's like it's ditto with the injured players. Like, how much can that form or lack thereof? Can you still just come in, know the system, be able to play at that level? And some players will be. And it'll be interesting to see with Leon, because even before this run where she hasn't played, it's always kind of been a question. Is she a starter? Is she off the bench? Because we've seen times where she comes off the bench and does damage, but also sometimes as a starter, and that's why she's kind of hovered in and out of the lineup, because there's been times where she's just completely won a spot. And it was a time where it was Fleming, or no, sorry, it was Becky and Leon who were the starting wingers. But then there's been other times where Leon struggled, and it's been Prince and Rose, or Becky playing at fullback. So I really think Leon's going to have a lot to prove in that regard, because we know what she can bring. But also, she's been inconsistent in that some weeks, sometimes for Canada, she can be playing great at club, or not playing at club, and she'll slot in and do well. But also, as we've seen, she can come in and be a bit quiet. So it is going to be interesting to see what version of Leon shows up to Australia.
When you're looking ahead to Canada's games, it starts on Thursday at 7:30 Pacific against Nigeria. Nigeria looking like they probably will play that game. It would take quite the boycott to boycott an opening World Cup game in terms of a labor dispute. But what do you see in this Nigerian team, as well as sort of the challenge that they're going to put towards Canada? Of course, they've got Oshoala, but how much of another challenge do they have for Canada?
Yeah, this Nigeria team is going to be a fascinating one, because they're kind of the sleeper team in this group, in my opinion. They're the pot four team, but they're not really a pot four team. Just, for whatever reason, I guess, at the FIFA rankings, African teams are in the women's rankings are ranked rather low. So I do wonder if that's maybe just because, lack of competitive games, because those will always boost the rankings, like teams like UEFA, where they've got all these nations leagues and long qualifiers. You can kind of get a boost in the rankings if you win a bunch of games. Whereas in Africa, they only have the women's AFCONs, and that's only like 3, 4, 5 games. So don't be fooled, basically, is what I'm saying, by the 40th rank of Nigeria, because they're one where you look at Ireland being ranked in the 20s. I'd say Nigeria arguably are the stiffer test, based on just, yeah, the talent level. I think certainly Asisat Oshoala is the main threat. Barcelona striker, she scores for fun. She has 30 goals and 41 caps for Nigeria. She scored over 100 goals for Barcelona across the 4 years. A 2 times Champions League winner, just such a talented player. There's a few other as well who can cause problems. Ajibade in midfield. Some might remember her from when Canada played Nigeria. She scored a backheel, I want to say. She got blue hair, hard to miss in midfield. And, her talent's a big reason why. She can score, she can combine on the ball. And then just across the roster, like, this is a solid team. There's a lot of teams, players playing in top leagues, or like the NWSL, England, France. So this is a team that's just very solid top to bottom. And what's the biggest thing to watch out for is they hold on to the ball and they play well. Like, this isn't going to be a team that's going to bunker down and completely try to frustrate Canada with fouls, etc. This is a team that likes to hold on to the ball, that can attack, can make things happen. They're talented enough. So for Canada, they'll have to be ready for a toe-to-toe battle. This isn't going to be, a typical 7 versus 40 game. I think Nigeria's ranking is a lot, does them a bit of a disservice. So I'm expecting a good game to open, and we'll really learn a lot about Canada, I think, in this opening game based on how they handled this challenge. Because heck, we even saw that when these two teams met twice, right? In the first game, Canada rose to the challenge and dominated. They won 2-0. It was a well-deserved win. They should have won more. But in the rematch in Victoria, it was 2-2. It was hard fought. Nigeria frustrated them. It took a late equalizer from Canada to even rescue a draw. So really, depending on what version of Canada we see, it could be very telling for what's to come in this tournament.
And they're not favored to win the group in any way, but some of the odds on Nigeria to win the group or advance are quite favorable in terms of payout, depending on what sports book you bet on. I mean, I'm not necessarily encouraging you to bet on them to win the group, but it could be enticing just given the length of those odds and the potential shot that they actually have of topping the group, because they've got a chance at it, you have to say. Because of the way that they pressed Canada in those two friendlies.
Well, exactly. They have a chance based on that. They have a chance based on just the way they play. Again, like, they're fearless, and I think teams like that can get rewarded. And they're pretty good defensively too. So if they can keep that up, that'll always help. And also, like, again, the Oshawala factor is worth noting because she's arguably the best player in this group. Like, I think it's I if I were to pick, I think it's Sam Kerr, but I think you could make a very compelling argument for Oshawala. And that's always, talent can also pay off in these World Cup games, right? Like, who's going to step up for you in that one key moment where it's nil-nil, 70th minute, ball falls to someone among players in the group? Like, Canada would be killing to have an Oshawala on their team to finish. So yeah, no, I think it's something where Nigeria does have a lot going for them, and that's why for Canada that was such a nightmare draw if you look at it in terms of pot four teams. That, yeah, you're looking at a lot of the other pot four options. Like, I'd take a lot of them before I would take Nigeria. And I mean, ditto with Ireland, who we can dive into as well. Like, there's this group is a tough one, and it's why I am more worried about this group for Canada than I am the knockout stages. Like, Canada, again, they're more built to play the knockout rounds these days under Bev Priestman, but this group's tough, and any hiccup could end up costing them.
I mean, I just looked up the odds on Nigeria to win the group, and they're +3,300, +550 to advance. So, I mean, that's a decent bet. But we're not going to get into the betting side too much for the Women's World Cup, unless a betting company is listening and would like to sponsor us. But no pressure there. Getting into the other opponents for Canada, of course, their second opponent of the tournament is Ireland. Ireland had to abandon a friendly ahead of the Women's World Cup after Lorena Bedoya injured Denise O'Sullivan. Colombia and Ireland playing a little bit too feisty in their friendly, which had to be abandoned in the 20th minute, given just how threatening that game was getting to the health of both players, both sets of players. When you look at that friendly, the way that Ireland played that one, the way that Colombia played that one, as well as just the challenge that Ireland is going to put forth to Canada, what do you necessarily see in the second group stage game?
I see what's going to be a very frustrating game. That's for sure. It's going to be the Ireland one. Really could it's it feels like this could be the trap game of the group. Nigeria is going to be a strong opener. Then Ireland's going to be the trap game, right? I think what's fascinating about Ireland as well is that they're just so good defensively. They're committed. What I also find hilarious is that they're the team that has got the most clear identity in the group. I was doing my statistical research for a piece that's dropping, and what I found fascinating between the three teams I researched in this group, Ireland's the one that by far is the most consistent with their formation and tactics. Because other teams like Australia, they bounce between three primary formations, one but they used about 40% of the time, another about 20%, another about 15. Ditto with Nigeria, they really bounce between two formations, and they've used about five or six. Ireland, they've used the 5-4-1 98% of the time. Like, it was the most clear by a landslide. Like, they play a 5-4-1, they're defensive, they play well off the ball, they try to counter, they try to hit you off corners, they try to hit you off set pieces. So for this one, it's just going to be frustration match for Canada. And, you know, at the same time, don't what's also interesting about Ireland is that they've got some players as well, right? Like, this isn't, they're going to be very defensive and sit behind the ball and frustrate, but also they're a team that have, they have threats to watch out for. Katie McCabe is a big one, the Arsenal fullback, her FB ref chart. She was amongst one of the best attacking fullbacks in all of Europe and the NWSL last year, because FB ref tracks across those leagues. So she'll be someone who likely play in midfield. She's someone to watch in the attack. As well, some other names to watch out are Denise O'Sullivan from North Carolina Courage as well in midfield. She's good on the ball, and she, you know, her and McCabe will really try to control the game. So it's something where this Ireland team actually has some sneaky good talent that maybe isn't talked about enough, and then they have a clear identity, they defend well. And again, that's tough for Canada, because Canada has struggled historically against these low blocks where teams sit back, force Canada to break them down. And it's something where a 0-0 or a loss against Ireland could be fatal for World Cup hope. So it's going to be a huge game for Canada in their second game, especially say they do draw Nigeria. If they draw again against Ireland, it would be panic stations heading into the hardest game of the group, which would be against Australia, who are hosting and are going to have that huge crowd advantage, as well as a talented team themselves.
Massive crowd, talented team. Sam Kerr leading that group. What does Australia offer in Canada's group stage finale?
Yeah, well, lastly for Australia, I mean, Kerr's the big one. I think she's just a talent amongst the best in the world, just a pure natural goal scorer. And why she's so good is she hurts you in every way. She can score at their left, she can score at their right. She's good in the air, she can hold up the ball. She can run in the channels. Like, she just, you know, like, you give her something and she'll take it, right? Like, you can sit deep, she's like, okay, I'll shoot from distance. Like, you can high line, I'll sneak behind you. So for Canada, just stopping the supply to Kerr in any way possible, 63 goals and 121 caps, over 200 goals at the club level. Like, that's all you need to know about Kerr. And, you know, what's interesting about Australia is they have a very clear identity of how they want to play with Kerr. It's get the ball to Kerr and get the ball to the attackers around her. So Australia are a bit of a chameleon. They can play counterattack, but they can also play in possession, and they're also good on set pieces. Really, for them, it's just you give them something, they'll take it. So for Canada, they'll just have to be wary of that and then try to break them down. Because one thing about Australia is they're very aggressive. They press higher than the other two teams in the group. They try to win the ball higher up the field. And when it works, it works. But also Canada has seen it. Remember against Australia in September, I think of this play when Jade Rose broke the press with a great turn, played Adriana Leon in behind, she scored. That's what you can do to Australia. If you break that press, catch their line high up the field, you will get chances. But also, if you get caught in possession, you will get punished if you're giving Sam Kerr a chance, a wide open opportunity in the box. So Kerr's the one to watch. But also, there's quite a few players. Well, 9 players on this Australian team have over 100 caps, which is by far the most experienced team in this group. Steph Catley, is a name that stands up amongst that group. Goalkeeper Lydia Williams, Caitlin Ford as well of Arsenal is another one that stands out. That veteran group should expect to carry the load, but also they have a couple of younger players. Haley Rasso isn't the youngest, say she's 27. She's a Man City. She's one to watch, but the two young players to keep an eye out, Mary Fowler of Man City. She's the fascinating one. She's 20. She plays for, obviously playing in England, already has 10 goals and 37 caps at her young age. That's no small feat on a team as big as Australia. And then Ellie Carpenter, just 23, 2-time Champions League winner. She's back from a knee injury and healthy for this tournament. If I'm not mistaken, if I haven't mixed it up. So that would be a huge boost. The Lyon player, and she's going to expect to play a big role likely at fullback.
And we went through our ideal starting 11 for Canada, but how do they stack up against Australia? What kind of 11 do you see Bev Priestman playing in that one?
I think for that one, it's just going to be, being wary of that press. So, making sure that Canada is able to play out the back. So maybe, again, playing Quinn in that pivot to help them and really go in that regard. And then from there, just be able to have the speed to get in behind. So hopefully in that game, you're hoping that Nichelle Prince is able to go maybe a 45, or, you know, certainly starting Chloe Lacasse. You're hoping Deanne Rose is good to go, because I think speed in behind is also going to be key if you can try to get behind that Australia backline like Canada did so well in those friendlies. So those would be two things I'd be watching for in a lineup. So, you know, back four that could play out, Riviere Lawrence at fullback, Quinn in midfield, and then that speed up front.
And how about Canada's starting lineup in that first match against Nigeria?
In terms of that one, I'd say just being wary of Nigeria's willingness to try and break them down defensively. So I do wonder if we could potentially maybe see a Chapman off the start as well, just to help that backline deal with the Oshawala and that, you know, Adibaje threat. If not, I'd probably still see Riviere starting though. And then from there, just Canada just being willing to put in, you know, that midfield so they can break down Nigeria off the ball, because Nigeria is very, very solid. And I'd like to see, I think that front, a group of Lacasse, Hoitema, because I think if you're going to be breaking them down, someone who can cut inside and cause problems from the interior half spaces, like a Lacasse on the wings, maybe even a Leon, like maybe we see that Hoitema, Lacasse, Leon to start, which could also allow you to ease in Rose and Prince throughout the tournament. I think those are some combinations that could make sense for the Nigeria match.
And getting into a couple predictions as well, who's going to lead Canada in scoring at this tournament? I'd say Jordan Hoitema, given her form with the OL Reign, but I mean, you could also see the potential of Adriana Leon, because she always seems to show up with the national team.
Yeah, I think Leon's going to be the one where, given she's been Canada's top scorer under Bev Priestman, so I think she's someone where I'd certainly have a look. Given what she can do, but given her form, I'd honestly lean a little more towards Jordan Hoitema. I think really the big thing for Hoitema though is, can Canada give her the service she thrives on? I think a lot of the times what's hurt Hoitema is that sometimes the players around her just instinctively play with her like she's Sinclair, and she's not. She plays a different style of game. She likes to get on the end of crosses. She can run those channels and get in behind. So if they can feed her that sort of service, I'd also put Hoitema certainly in that mix. And just given that she scores seemingly everywhere she plays, surely if Evelyn Vian gets a couple starts, she's also someone where you give her a half chance, she'll find a way to bury it. So, I mean, it's, you know, I almost, you know, her, she seems the one that if Canada struggles to, you know, maybe get Hoitema the service she can thrive on. Vian is someone where you could give her subpar service, and she always seems to turn it into a bit more, right? We think of that goal she scored against Brazil in February. She believes the ball just pops up for in the box for a second. She slams it home. Like, that's what Vian could do for her, is do for you as well. So between those two, should be fascinating to see.
And I don't know if you filled out a bracket, but if you have, what would be your every group prediction for this tournament, as well as your semifinals, how far Canada's going to go, and your final and winner?
Well, how about you? I mean, I guess to start, I'll roll through, because I'd say to start, I think the Group A is going to be tough. I'd probably say New Zealand, Norway, though. I mean, the hosts and that Norway team, that is a bit of a group of life. I'd say for Group B, I'd still think Australia, Canada. I think Nigeria is going to cause a lot of noise. Australia as hosts should get through. And I think it would be a huge disappointment if Canada doesn't get through. Group C, that one's, I could lean a bit more open, because Zambia with Barbara Banda is one where they could also very well disrupt that group. And Spain is a bit weak and given everything that's going on, but I still think Spain gets through. But I also, you know what, I'm going to throw in Zambia. I think I don't know. They beat Germany in that friendly lately. Japan, always a dangerous team, but they're not the same Japan team they used to be. So I'll go Spain and Zambia. Group D, I think ultimately England and Denmark, although China and Haiti, that's going to be a very tough group. But we've seen this has kind of been a European-dominated competition. So until proven otherwise, that's what I'd lean on. Group E, again, U.S. and Netherlands. Even though Netherlands, no Vivian Medema, still going to be a dangerous team. Group F, France and Brazil. I think that's going to be pretty straightforward. Jamaica with Bunny Shaw, again, dangerous teams. And the last few ones, Sweden and Italy on Group G, and then I think it's going to be Group H. That's a fascinating one. I'd go Germany, and I'd go South Korea. I think Morocco as well could be very dangerous. They've grown a lot, but I don't know. I feel South Korea, but I think the group stage is you can tell that there's usually for the most part there's a clear 1-2 in each group, so that's probably who I'd have in terms of an overall bracket. I don't have a bracket written out, but I'd say the teams I'd be seeing going all the way. I mean, I think the US, I just think it's something where not enough teams have stood up as a clear contender to oppose them. Although I think England as well would be the US and England would be my two main favorites. And you know what? Based on what I saw, I'd say Australia as a team, just given that they'll have the home field advantage, they've got a deep team. It could be something where this lack of favorite could benefit Australia and they could end up making a run to the semis, I'd say, is something I could preview, because Australia's actually never made it past the quarterfinals. So I could see them making a bit of history on home soil.
I've got pretty similar predictions when it comes to the group stage. In Group A, I've got Norway and Switzerland making their way through. I don't have New Zealand making their way through. I think the host favoritism is not necessarily as important in a split World Cup, as well as when you look at New Zealand and they're lacking ticket sales for this tournament compared to Australia. In Group B, I have Australia top in the group, Canada in second. Group C, Spain and Japan, but I have Spain winning the group, even though they don't have all of their top players. England, Denmark in Group D. The US top in the group, with the Netherlands just in behind them in Group E. France and Brazil in Group F. As you said, Bunny Sean, Jamaica could cause some trouble, but I don't think it'll be enough to move through the group stage. Group G, I've got a bit of an upset. I just have a hunch Argentina might push their way through. It might be a little bit of a Cinderella story for Argentina, and I have Sweden topping the group, Germany and South Korea advancing in Group H. And then when you scroll down and look at my semifinals, I've got the US against the Netherlands, US winning that one, and France beating Germany. Canada goes out in the quarterfinals along with Australia in the quarterfinals, Canada losing to Germany, Australia losing to France, and then I have a US France final with the US completing their three-peat for their fifth World Cup. So I think when you're looking at the United States, it's just they all play in the NWSL pretty much, except Lindsey Horan. But they're just an overpowered team in terms of just the consistency with that group and the experience, as well as the young talent. There's just so much about the United States that is so consistent in every part of the field that it's going to be hard to defeat at any point.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because I think personally this is the weakest US team I've seen of the three. Of the last three, of course, the last two they won. But it's just something where, and yeah, under Vlatko Andonovski as well, it feels like it's something where the coaching as well isn't the same, as it was before. But still, it's something where it's just the talent level could take over. And we've seen they step up in these moments, right? Just right when they seem wounded. They lose a couple games, they'll find a way to get it done, right? It was like last year's CONCACAF Championships. It felt like Canada could take over, and yet the US just showed up in the big moments. And again, they still have these players. Like Sophia Smith just looks like she's going to be an absolute problem this tournament. Rose Lavelle looks like she'll be healthy, and she is just such a fun midfielder to watch. Yeah, it's just something where the pieces are there for the US. I mean, Alex Morgan as well continues to have a late career resurgence. That overall, I think that talent boost, that familiarity is just going to pay off for them. And for the most part as well, like what's been huge is they've avoided a lot of these big injuries, right? Like they're not sitting there like the Netherlands, a team who, after 2019 they make a final, would want to build it off. Well, Miedema's out injured, and that's just something where that's just such a huge blow. And you look at Spain as well, like it looks like they were on track to be a dark horse, and then their federation has kind of robbed them of being able to turn these Barcelona team that's running over everyone in Europe, right? And you're just not able to get that over with the national team. So that hurts Spain. England, the defending Euro champions, they end up losing someone like Beth Mead due to a major knee injury. Like it's something where it's just, yeah, amongst all that, the US is kind of the only team where they haven't really dealt with that. Like they've got most of their players back healthy. They've got that depth. Like it's something where this is going to be the US's tournament. And really, I'm just going to be fascinated to say, if the US loses, how do they lose? Because the one thing we've seen with this US team is that they're gritty, they're resilient. They find a way. So who is going to be the team that's able to usurp them? France could be a good shout. I like your potential France show with under Hervé Renard, who, you know, is a bit of a strong tactician as we've seen. But between them and England, those feel like the two teams that could push them. If not, it's it feels like it's US's tournament to lose. But hey, I'd love to be proven wrong.
Would love to hear your predictions on the tournament as well. Make sure that to tweet them, thread them, tag us wherever on whatever social media. I guess not Blue Sky and Mastodon if you're still waiting for everyone on Twitter to transition over there. But getting into our men's national team chat and a bit of a reflection on the Gold Cup, a lot of your questions on this. Again, please ask more questions on the women's side of the tournament. We'll have coverage on that all tournament long for the World Cup. But yeah, getting into the men's national team, Ted Barda, with the players available for the Gold Cup, was this team better suited to play a defensive game and try to hit teams on the break? Of course, Canada did hit on the break quite a few times in the quarterfinal loss to the US, but wasn't quite doing that throughout the tournament.
I'd say it's a good question, because it's like, I think there's no doubt Canada's better suited to play on the break. I think you could say that as well with their best team. But also it feels like something where they want to evolve past that. And it feels like they should, you know, continue to evolve, especially at the top level. So, yeah, I think it's something where certainly they were better suited to playing defensively. But also I think it's good that they continue to try and grow that side of the game, because I think it's going to pay off, especially at that next level. Like, it's that's a huge difference maker, right? Is being able to play on the ball. So yeah, I think they were better suited to that. And I think we saw against the US, they were able to play their best game by sitting a little deeper off the ball. But I don't hate the approach in the group stage. Really the bigger issue with the group stage, and that's kind of what we talked about last time out, is it was more just the surprising personnel that we saw and just the lack of young players. And, you know, play, especially you're wanting to play on the ball in the group stages. Where was Victor Latoury, right? Like, those were the bigger questions. I think it's something that, no doubt, you put all these, especially these veteran players, you put them behind the ball, that's where they thrived. And I think it's not surprising that they played as well as they did against the US when they were put into a more comfortable position.
And from Pierre-André Sir, how would you currently rate the depth of our midfield player pool? Your thoughts on Ali Ahmed, Moise Bombito playing out of position, Victor Latoury barely getting minutes, and Mathieu Chouanier getting snubbed on the initial roster, although he might have had a call if healthy when Astakio pulled out.
Yeah, I mean, the midfield pool continues to be an interesting one, because I think the depth still needs to continue to grow. I think Ahmed was a huge revelation. Again, huge to see his performance, and I think you can just see already that the glimpse he gave us in his return to the white cap shows. Like, I think he's someone that looks ready for that first team, which is huge. That's another piece. But yeah, it's something where there's so many questions that you need to see more. Like, Chouanier is someone where I'd want to see him get that chance to see if he can help out. I'd love to see more of Latoury. I think something with Bombito, it's, again, that's a long-term project. Park that one and get back to me on that one. So yeah, I'd love to really see more midfielders, and I'm going to be curious to see how they approach these, you know, fall friendlies, because based on all indications, despite the earlier reports that they might not play those friendlies, it looks like, you know, they'll still remain on as of now. So assuming they end up do playing those friendlies, I'm curious to see what they do to address that midfield group, because I feel like if you're calling it up today, like, you'd see Stakio, you'd see Kone, you'd see Ahmed, you'd see Azorio, you'd see Chouanier. So it's like, okay, can they get some other faces to include in there? Because, you know, would it be too early to call in a Nathan Saliba potentially? Would it be, you know, Samuel Piet is back healthy? Could he help out? Yeah, there's a lot of questions at midfield, and I hope it's something in those friendlies where they really use that camp as a chance to look at options in the middle, because they certainly need it.
One of the players who definitely did establish himself within that group was Jacob Schaffelberg, and that was the question from Northern Football Fan. The pride of Nova Scotia, Jacob Schaffelberg, deserves more minutes with the A-team. Do you agree? Who else should and will be getting more minutes with the A-team in the future after impressing at this Gold Cup? And I think the other name that has to come up is Ali Ahmed with the way that he played.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, something where he was the leader in that regard. I think Ahmed's the one that really stepped up, and it's huge. Position of need, midfielder. You could see him potentially slotting in with Kone Eustachio, which is a, you know, an area of need in that first team. I think Jakob Schaffelberg is a great shout just because, again, he showed that he can be a depth energy piece. And what's nice with Schaffelberg, he's someone where you're not looking at being like, he needs to start to thrive. He can come in off the bench and you could throw him the spot start if need be. And I think that enough can't be said about guys who can sometimes be able to play 20, 30 off a bench. Because sometimes, as we see, there's some great players who at their clubs, they're 90-minute players. As soon as they come into an environment where they only have to play 10, 20, 30, they might not thrive. And I think that Schaffelberg showed he's able to come in off the bench is key. Otherwise, again, I think a lot of it comes down to potentials. Like, I want to see Bombito in the first team, but I want to see him as a center back. So it's something where did he show enough at center back to get earn a bigger look? I'd certainly say he did, but that one you could have a debate. I think I'd want to see more St. Clair get minutes with the first team because even though he was nervous on the ball against the US, he showed what he could do in terms of shot stopping, his size, his command of the area. So yeah, I think there's a few who could earn bigger roles. I mean, yeah, you could go through Jason Russell-Rowe as well at some point. If he can continue to get minutes at Columbus, that striker pool isn't exactly loaded. So if he's someone who could also earn a few more minutes. So there were a few young players that did step up, and ultimately that's what the tournament's about. And it only makes you wonder, what could these guys have done with bigger roles? Like, what could have a Schaffelberg done starting? What could a Russell-Rowe have done with bigger roles? Ahmed Bombito playing natural, Bombito playing in a natural position. So yeah, it only makes you wonder.
And from BTC time, whose stock dropped the most and who failed in potentially their last audition with the Canadian men's national team?
Feels like it was a lot of the veterans. I mean, a lot of them stepped up in the end in that last game, but still, like, you're looking across at the board at that team. I think, for example, someone like Steven Vitoria. That one's a bit of a difficult one. But I think we saw both the good when when he stepped up, but also we saw again the teams are starting to look at him. As you just look at the way the US went right at him on their opening goal in that 2-2 thriller, the ball right over the top caught Vitoria in no man's land. Vasquez got on the blind spot. So it's something where Vitoria, his stock didn't necessarily drop, but we kind of saw, okay, Canada does need a replacement there long term. So that was something that stood out. Lucas Cavallini as well in that last game, really, we saw that maybe he is someone that guys like Jason Russell-Rowe, Ike Ugbo should be pushing him in that regard. So that was something that stood out. Elsewhere, I think Milan Borjan something as well, where Dane Sinclair pushed him, did a lot to show that he can potentially supplant him. Dominic Zator was something where, unfortunately, just given the his. You know, the fact he was on the field for such a short time, two goals kind of came from his side slash through him. Something where I do wonder with Bombito being able to play right center back, of course, Alistair Johnston being able to play there, some other names stepping up could be tough for Zator. In that next camp, he's really gonna have to go back to club level and really push. Elsewhere, Scott Kennedy as well. His move to Austria is gonna be fascinating because I think he's gonna need that just reset for a new season because his confidence just seems to have cratered a bit. So those are kind of the ones I'd say between the rest. Because I think if anything, a few, of course, Ahmed's stock went up. Junior Hoilett, for me, his stock went up just because I think he's someone where if you're going to have a veteran player that's going to be in 2026, he's the one I bet my money on. He's just the one who continues to age like a fine wine. So I think Junior Hoilett's stock went up among, of course, along with some of the other names that we saw. So I'd say those are the main options of to answer that question.
And from Vince Alvarado, do you guys think that this Canadian team shouldn't bunker when we have leads late? I feel like they can't do desperation defending. Didn't work against Guadeloupe in the US, and we nearly drew Mexico 2-2 in World Cup qualifying to Edmonton after deciding to bunker. This team can't soak up pressure late.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they develop that side of their game because it remains, a bit of an issue that just where they sit deep and when they try and get behind the ball like that, they can almost sit a little too deep. And I think for Canada, really, the big thing, as we've seen, they defend better deep. But I think what also has changed is they can't have their midfield pressure drop off too much. I think as soon as they start letting teams play through their lines, start getting those crosses in from the, those wide areas after they beat that midfield wave, that's kind of where they got hurt. So I'd say something where it's not so much as bunkering, but just how they bunker. And I think what killed them against the US is that they scored and it was almost just like, oh shoot, there's like 10 minutes left. Let's just everyone back. And that's not going to be a recipe for success. So it's important that it shows how important, really, for me, how important their press is to their game. Because as soon as they start dropping off their high press, their midfield block, when those things start going, I think the rest of the defense does as well. So I think it just shows how important it is defending from the front, defending from other areas of the pitch.
And from Jordan SC, was John Herdman shoehorning Bombito into midfield at the expense of other players? And why weren't more midfielders brought into this camp?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? Where were the other midfielders? And again, the Bombito one just continues to remain puzzling because, again, like, it's something where an experiment across a game or two makes sense. But for the whole tournament, it was a bit of a surprise. And I mean, again, I think it's something where that wasn't really at the expense of another player who wasn't in the squad, because it should have been Mathieu Chouinard, yes, but he got injured in the end. So didn't miss out on that regard. But yeah, I think in the squad, really, the big surprise is no Victor Leturia. I mean, I guess we were not privy to how he was doing at training, and maybe that was a big reason why he wasn't able to get more minutes. But just it was a surprise to see Bombito certainly it being shoved in at that 6-4 Leturia in particular, because you could argue at the number eight positions, the depth was maybe not there as much. David Weatherspoon was on the bench, and it's someone where his fitness maybe wasn't fully there. But certainly at the sixth, the Bombino one did not make as much sense because of Leturi. But it's obviously something where, maybe his training wasn't good enough, and that potentially cost him in the end.
Was Canada naive not taking a competition like this seriously? The Americans can at least say they've won the competition multiple times, while Canada struggled until recently to get out of group stages.
Oof, this is the twofold question, isn't it? I think it's something where I think Canada, yes, should be taking it more seriously, but also, like, it's hard to say, again, like, could you want the big guns there? Yes, but I find it hard to blame them when the schedule is just so ridiculous from CONCACAF, right? Like, I think it's something where it's frustrating for national teams where you have to do so much relationship building just to get your players to play in a tournament like this. And for CONCACAF, there's no excuse why this tournament shouldn't be every 4 years, first of all, so that so that teams aren't going, oh, we'll release them in 2 years, we'll release them in 2 years. And then it should just be earlier in the summer. Like, it's this final ended Sunday, right? Teams are in, like, for example, Croatia on the same Sunday, they're playing their Super Cup, like the start of their domestic season. Like, there's leagues across Europe. There's UEFA Champions League qualifiers started. Like, Milan Borjan last Wednesday played in a Champions League qualifier for Slovan Bratislava. It's something where for him, like, these players and for a club, and yes, you can make the argument like country over club. Again, that's something where like it has to be done in isolation, because again, as we've seen in the past, sometimes you make a decision country over club. I mean, Craig Forrest has seen it in the past. Can hurt you. It can really hurt you. Alex Bunbury is another example. Shout out to the Voyageurs book, right? Joshua Cloke telling us all these stories. So really, I'd say it's something where yes, Canada maybe should be prioritizing it more, but also I'm not sitting here looking at Canada like they could. Like, I'm also think CONCACAF also has some of the blame, and also like if you're CONCACAF, does it really benefit you to be having a tournament where look at your federation. You have all these great players who are in your federation, and all of them are gone. Like, is that great for your federation? That Pulisic, Timothy Weah, Alphonso Davies, Jonathan David, Kyle Larin, Stefan Eustachio, Weston McKennie. Like, is it good for your federation that they're not there? And yes, you can make the argument that Jamaica were able to call up a bunch of Premier League players, but even then, that's like that almost feels like an exception. And even, in that case, English preseason just started. It's something where really the players that are getting hurt aren't so much the Premier League players. It's a lot of these players where in leagues where their seasons do start a bit earlier, or guys who are making transfers, right? Because, you know, guys like Leon Bailey, Jamari Gray, they aren't going anywhere at the clubs, club level. They're not that in that similar situation. So I think as much as it is on Canada to maybe push these guys, I understand it for them. They have a Copa America next year. You do not want to piss any federations off before then. So I'd say for CONCACAF, they really do have to look themselves in the mirror in that regard, because, okay, maybe every 2 years the Gold Cup's for money purposes, but if that's the case, move it earlier in the calendar so at least you're getting more marquee talent to come, because it benefits no one to be having these B teams, because now we don't really know who the best team in CONCACAF is. You're missing out on stars. It takes away some of the allure of the tournament. Personally, as soon as Canada went out, it was hard to watch just because it was like, yeah, Panama, it means a lot to Panama. I was happy to watch Panama's games, but I was like, U.S. sent a B team, who cares? Or a C team, as they'll argue. Even Mexico missing a few stars. Like, it's just not good for the tournament. It's something they do have to look at.
And also from Vince Alvarado, was there actual interest in Joel Waterman and Kamal Miller? Whatever rumors there were have completely dried up, and it's a bit disappointing that our center back depth is trending into the MLS Lafer or equivalent league area. I mean, a positive is they're going to be matched up against Messi. Kamal Miller is going to go up against him every day in training, so that can only help. But yeah, it would be better if they move to a top five league.
Absolutely, and I think it's something that's going to be a work in progress, right? I think the big game changer is going to be those players right now who are between the ages of 16 and 23. So I think also just have to remember, with a lot of the Canada's center backs that have emerged, right? Like even guys like Hebert, McNaughton, Waterman, they're all kind of in those mid to late 20s. And there was interest in Waterman, no doubt. Like there was interest. It's just something where, you know, sometimes interest is just that interest. Anything concrete didn't come out of it. Ditto with Kamal Miller. It's like Olivier Renard mentioned, right? Like when they asked at the beginning of the year, were there any offers for Kamal Miller? No offers hit the table, right? Sometimes interest doesn't lead to offers, but also it's something, yeah, where they're at a lot of these center backs are at an age where it's going to be tougher for them to make those big moves, right? Like it's going to take superhuman seasons, et cetera. So really I'd be watching those guys in those 18 to 23 ranges. I'd be looking at a guy like Bombito, for example, with his potential. If he can really find his feet, he'll be at an age where, okay, some team might snap him up in Europe and then he'll be able to take that step up. Heck, just to throw some names out there, I'd be looking at guys like Matteo Campagna at Whitecaps, guys like Lazar Stefanovic and Adam Perlman at TFC. Those guys who are 18. Why? Because center backs don't peak till they're 24, 25. The fact that some of these guys I mentioned are already in the MLS Next Pro / first team systems, it's something where if they can get on at 18, 19, have a good season or two, top teams will be looking at that. So I think really for Canada, what we're seeing is catching up from that void that was there between those center backs that 3 to 4 years ago were in that 18 to 23 range now, and now they're in their mid to late 20s. They didn't get their opportunities till late because of the CPL or in MLS. And now MLS teams are thriving because of that. Like there's such a good group of them between Hebert, McNaughton, Waterman, Miller, you go across the board, but now what we're going to have to see is, okay, can the CPL, for example, build up that infrastructure? We saw a taste of it. You know, guys like Karifa Yao getting opportunities in their 20s, that helped a bit. Eric Lajeunesse is 19, getting regular opportunities in the CPL. That will also help. Can more opportunities like that crop up? Anthony White as well at Vancouver FC, just 19. Can more of those players emerge? And then it's something where we might not see them for a few years, but I think that's where that gap will be made up over time.
And lastly, from Binatch 2, any rumors about September friendlies and who we might play? So sad that the association is claiming to be broke, as we need to start playing good teams from Europe and South America to truly gauge where we stand as a team at every position. And to that, I'll say, if you're looking to watch international soccer in Canada in September, there's a Women's Olympic qualifier on September 27th that is pretty critical for Canada's journey to the Paris 2024 Olympics. They are playing Jamaica in a two-leg playoff, so go to that. I will urge you to. But hopefully there are friendlies in September as well. And from what we've heard, it does seem possible.
Well, that's all I'd say. I think it's something where the report that came out was, again, it was something where it was It was like the bankruptcy. It was like the friendlies. It was a lot of ifs. It was a lot of hypotheticals, right? It was like Canada, you know, of course, with the money situation, were considering not playing friendlies. But also, as we've seen since then, there's that possibility, like The Athletic reported, of the FIFA loan, which would help get that out of the way. So all I'd say is, the last I've heard, the door for friendlies in the fall is very much open. And, you know, sounds like they've even moved a bit further ahead than we've even expected. So hopefully we can, you know, get some positive news in the summer, hopefully maybe even in Canada, because I think it would be huge for Canada to potentially play some friendlies, you know, the men's national team in Canada in the fall. But I would say is things have changed since that original report saying no friendlies in bankruptcy. Let's just say that much.
And that's all we've got for episode 130 of the Northern Football Podcast. Alex, thanks so much for joining us once again. And apologies to the listener for the delay in releasing this podcast, but Gold Cup review down, we can shut that door and leave that one in the past. Women's World Cup coming up, that opener on Thursday, and certainly exciting stuff there with Canada's potential in this competition. But for Alex, I've been Ben. Thanks so much for listening to the Northern Football Podcast, episode 130.